something that you don't want, so I'm not going to do much talking today. We're going to do a very short, almost called a tap-tap hearing on Senate Bill 1125. So I'll open the public hearing on that. Learned counsel.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1125 modifies Oregon law related to condemnation. In the 1997 legislature passed Senate Bill
1036,
which substantially revised Oregon law. The proponents of this measure assert that that has resulted in quite a bit of confusion with regard to notice provisions and review of appraisals at trial and before trial. And while they propose six specific changes to Oregon law, the way Senate Bill 1125 right now is drafted, they're not urging its passage. We've been working with both proponents, Mr. John Duncan and Don Palmer from the Assessors Association and the Department of Transportation. And I'd expect that we have amendments back to you by the end of next week for your consideration. And for the record, I do have a copy of Mr. Junkin's letter outlining what his specific concerns are. We'll enter that for the record.
And there is a work group. I understand they meet again next week.
Wednesday morning, yeah.
So if any committee members have interest in the technicalities of condemnation, this is your chance. With that, we'll close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 1125. Before we go to the next bill, you might want to see the schedule for tomorrow. We'll meet in hearing room A. Would that be the wrong schedule?
Yeah, that would be the schedule.
And we'll have to do a series of tap-tap, then probably about 1:15 begin on Senate Bill 555. Mm-hmm. I expect a lot of interest. The governor may come down and testify.
Okay. More important than this committee?
Even more important.
There is no more important committee in this building.
I'm the chair.
But
call the power.
This hearing room A, I can do it with one person with the tap-taps we need to, and then we'll, as I said, 1:15 probably on 555. So if you can remind our colleagues about that tomorrow. Is anyone else on your committee that is serves in judiciary? Okay.
I'll need to leave about 3:45.
You will all leave by.
Okay.
Be my goal. Next, we will, before we get to the PERS matters, we're going to go to a public hearing on Senate Bill 1206. We have several people signed up to testify, which is wonderful. There's no one in opposition, which is also wonderful. And I understand there's going to be some amendments that aren't ready today. So what I'd like for you to do, as you testified, you could be brief. We have a special joint session at 4:30. We have to go to, no, have to, we will go to. And so I'm going to adjourn about 4:20, 4:25. So with that, please come forward and identify yourself.
Good afternoon, Chair Bryant, members of the committee. Richard Vile, the law firm of Vile Fotheringham in Portland. With me is David Bennett of Copeland Lanny Bennett Wolf and Howard Fierstein of the Stoll Reeves firm in Portland. We're going to take just a couple of minutes and outline the purpose for this bill, give you a brief overview of it, and that's all we'd like to do at this point. As the chair has indicated, we do have some amendments that we expect to be made, and we think we have consensus on those, so that should go smoothly once this is over. Senate Bill 1206 is an effort to meld two portions of the law that deals with homeowner associations in the state of Oregon. The Oregon Condominium Act has been around since the early 70s. It was previously called the Oregon Unit Ownership Law. It is the law that covers the horizontal regime development of property, or in other words, those properties that only involve airspace units, if you want to buy airspace. But that's not the only type of homeowner association we have in Oregon. And recently, certainly more popular has become the what we call gated community or planned community, those properties where some portions of the property are held in common. Frequently, these are driven by local land use requirements, where cities or counties are now requiring more and more of the subdivisions that are developed to take responsibility for some of their own infrastructure, be it a storm detention pond, their roads and streets, their lighting, or whatever those elements may be, clear up to clubhouses, golf courses, etc. Currently, the Oregon Planned Community Act is the only legislation that we have that covers these non-condominium homeowner associations. The Oregon Planned Community Act was adopted in 1981. At that time, this same group that we're representing today, which we've called the Condominium Working Group since the mid-70s, was participating in the adoption of the Planned Community Act, but it was driven largely by a very healthy consumer protection bent, and the fact of the matter is that the developers have simply not used it. There are many ways to get out of using the bill. Primarily, there is a de minimis provision that allows most developers to find a way to reduce the assessments or figure out another way not to come under the bill. As a result, most of the projects in Oregon that are not condominiums have not been developed under the Oregon Condominium or Oregon Planned Community Act. This effort is an effort to move these two acts, the Condominium Act and the Planned Community Act, closer together so that those who are directly involved in the homeowner association industry are not confused by the major differences in the way these homeowner associations are currently structured because of the differences in the law. I'd just like to tell you that the group that has worked on this includes members of the bar, including members of the bar that represent developers, members of the bar that represent homeowner associations, members of the bar that represent individual owners in bringing actions against developers involved in homeowner association development, and members of the bar who represent collection matters with respect to homeowner associations. We also have accountants. We have members of the management community who have participated directly on this committee, and others. We believe we've tried to be as comprehensive and inclusive in representing all aspects of the professional community that deal with homeowner associations. It's a very long bill. We apologize for the length of the bill because it touches upon a multitude of items, but the reason for that is primarily because there were so many places where the two things were inconsistent, and this was an effort to make them consistent. So with that, both David Bennett and Howard Feierstein have a couple of comments on specific aspects of the bill.
And again, committee, although we have a summary of the Dashwood amendments, they're still an LC, so the summary is very good, but we don't have those amendments yet.
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bryant, members of the committee, my name is David Bennett. Howard and I were around while I think Rich might still be in law school.
That's correct.
1981, when the Planned Community Act came up, Betty Niven, who was then head of the State Housing Commission, was on that committee. And concerned about some of the things that he talked about. One of the things was a consumer protection aspect to it. And since that time, there's been some modifications to ORS Chapter 105 in consumer disclosures and real estate transactions, which did not exist at that time. And so there's a lot more disclosure and protection for consumers who are buying into planned communities. But, as Rich said, a lot of people, including the three of us, representing developers who didn't want to come under the Planned Community Act because of some of the strange natures of it, have opted out of it. And yet, when we represent associations, we find out that people, if we didn't draft them, hopefully we drafted them right, but the other lawyers sometimes not as familiar with it, draft things, or developers that don't have really some meaningful provisions in them, or maybe they have common area responsibilities, common maintenance responsibilities, and haven't provided for any association to take care of those responsibilities. So one thing we've done is gotten rid of the consumer protection aspect of it, the disclosure requirements, which at best weren't very didn't disclose very much. It was confusing to the public. It was confusing to the developers. It constantly had to be changed. Some of the questions couldn't really be answered very well. And it simply didn't work very well. We felt that Chapter 105 and those disclosures worked a lot better, and we continue to feel that way. However, we do think that it is inappropriate to opt out of having an association. So we've tried to make it with the changes to the Planned Community Act that in most instances you would have to have you'd have to comply with the Act and have a homeowners association if you had any common property to be maintained. If previously we had a de minimis provision that kind of followed the Fannie Mae requirements with respect to 20 lots or less, also with respect to the amount of the assessment, it was 2% or less of the fair market value of the land. We've reduced that so that the minimum requirements now, if it's 12 lots or under, it wouldn't be under the Act, or if the assessment was $100 per unit or $1,000 in total, then it would not be under the Act. Other than that, it would come under the Act, and it would require there to be a homeowners association that's commonly maintained property. One of the problems you would see is that developers would come in and would say, we'll have a private street, there are 25 lots, and you all own 1/25th of it. Well, there's some substantial liability to that. And it's a lot better to have an association in it. As Rich said, we've tried to make it parallel to the Condo Act. Rich and I particularly represent a lot of associations, and people sometimes are confused about how the Act works, and there's not as good a mechanism in the Planned Community Act. There has not been for associations as there has been in the Condo Act. We've worked on the Condo Act more in the 25 years that we've been on this committee and come to the legislature, and now I think that association protection of the people who live in these associations and that structure is a lot better than it has been in the past.
I want to make one quick comment before Howard begins. I want to give credit to Barbara Kahns of Oregon Title, who has chaired this sort of ad hoc committee since the mid-70s. She's continued to be active in the process. She's here with us today. She's reluctant to say much, but I can promise you that she is the behind-the-scenes reason why we have been able to get the condominium things done over the years and certainly why we're here today. Just wanted to make that comment.
And I want to assure you this is not a lengthy bill compared to some of the other bills as far as presented this list from LLCs and LLPs and the rewriting of the banking laws.
That's encouraging.
I'm Howard Feuerstein. I'm with Phil Reeves in Portland, Oregon. In my practice, I represent a lot of developers, and I represent some homeowners associations. I just want to kind of go back to 1981 when the Planned Communities Act was enacted. At that time, we did not have a lot of experience with planned unit developments. There were Sun Rivers and Stellashans and a few others like that, but not a lot of experience with it. Also, we knew that the Act covered a broad scope of different types of developments, and it's pretty well understood that at the first shot at this Act was not going to be a perfect Act. It is going to, that over time it would have to be fine-tuned and whatever errors were in it would have to be fixed up. That has never happened, in part because shortly after the Act was enacted, the real estate market was such that there really weren't very many developments of this type. There really wasn't a demand to use this Act because the economy just did not call for this type of development. As you probably know, that has drastically changed. Developments with common facilities, common ownership, cluster housing, all that sort of thing has been a virtual explosion within the last few years. The other problem was that because of the flaws in the Act, developers tended to avoid the Act because they did not want to get into the confusion as to whether they were in compliance or not in compliance, didn't know how to comply, and so forth. So the Act wasn't being used. For all those reasons, the Act was never really updated and corrected during that period of time. And we just simply can't wait any longer now to get that done. And as we balance the different concerns here, the priorities in revising the Act, one of the highest priorities we had was to get projects in under this Act. Because even the original Act had a lot of good things in it. And with this bill will have a lot more really good things in it for homeowners associations, but those weren't being implemented because of the flaws. And so what we've tried to do is make this Act so it's easy for developers to use. There's not a penalty to using this Act. In fact, there's a benefit because then they can have confidence that the projects that they create will in the long run be good projects in the community and something they can be proud of having developed. So we think that that in balancing these back and forth, that expanding the Applicability Act, but making the Act usable and desirable and helpful has been the best result. And that's our basic intent here.
Barbara Kahns has prepared for us a summary of Senate Bill 1206, which I'd invite you to take a look at. It looks like this. And it's about a six or seven, eight-page document that simply goes section by section, gives a brief purpose of the changes made to that section. I'd like to point out just a couple of those as examples of the kind of thing that Howard was simply, or a moment ago, talking about as being improvements. For example, Section 7 requires a reserve account to cover the cost of repair or replacement of certain property. That's a good example of the kind of thing that was not being used by developers in the non-condominium type of project. This act would now fold that in so that it's consistent with the condominium law. Another one is Section 12. This is the beginning of a section that deals with the declarant. The declarant is the person that's developing, making the declaration or recording the document of CC&Rs, as it's often called. These sections ensure that the declarant control provisions are consistent between the Condominium Act and the Planned Community Act, another place where we were frequently experiencing significant confusion. And then there is one major section, for example, down in Section 25 that clears up the obligation of owners and the declarant to pay assessments, and the lien process is clarified. There have been some questions in the past, and again, inconsistencies between the two types of development. I highlight these only as examples of the type of thing that are included in the bill to ensure that, again, consistency between the two types of developments and lack of confusion among all of the professionals who are involved in the process. That's all we have in terms of a formal presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions. And again, many others of our committee are here to answer questions that we may not be specifically advised on.
Thank you. And committee? Yes.
Yes. Mr. Chair, we passed out a bill on the Senate floor a couple days ago concerning the notice requirements.
Yes.
So it was just a very small, it wasn't nearly as complex. Is that included within this bill? Or?
No, it Senator Bryant, Senator Nelson, that is Senate Bill 451. It was at the request of a homeowner over in Central Oregon. We frankly were a bit embarrassed that we hadn't thought of it, and we certainly are in support of it, and we have, actually, I think it's in your packet somewhere, because we intend to try and move those through together from this point on.
That's what I was getting at.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Senator.
I couldn't remember the number, though, Senator. I'm not quite there yet. I'm working on it.
It's a good bill.
It is a dandy bill.
We'll make sure the conflict amendment is appropriate. Rather than ask questions today, since we don't have the Dash 1 amendment, I think we'll just accept it. The testimony. And probably we'll bring this back for a work session and move it next week.
Okay.
Next Thursday, I understand, it's already scheduled.
A week from today, same time then?
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. The other people who signed up, and if I find my sign up list here. Here we go. I got it. You've all signed up in support of this. You're welcome to come forward and say a few words if you want. Our intent is to pass the bill out, so as I call your name, tell me if you'd like to specify Linda Triplett. Scott Bellows? You're okay, thank you. The infamous Barbara Kahn? Okay.
Infamous?
Well, she was his wishes name.
The word famous. Infamous is sort of her.
Ruth Thompson? Rich, I'm sorry, Rich. Any additional testimony? And Steve Hawes. Okay. Thank you, then. And again, if you're interested, you're welcome back on Thursday as we work the Dash 1 amendments. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1206. Committee, we're now going to go into PERS. And, yes, I will open a... I guess, is this such a thing as an informational? This is an informational meeting. I thought we either had to be a public hearing or a work session. What you have in front of you is a pink slip that I'm going to have. It describes the pieces of legislation before us. And Anne, if you could briefly use your voice to touch on these, then we'll call up Mark Johnson, who you met last time, who's the actuary, who will provide testimony on the different Tier 3 options, what they mean, and then we'll have a discussion about the questions we pose and now have some answers to. So, Ann, if you'd walk us through, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they're all the same bills that were heard on March 23rd and 24th. There's nothing new on this list, but just by way of a reminder, Senate Bill 721 is the bill that would require a split calculation for legislative service and any other public employee service that a member of the legislature would actually perform, and specifies that the final average salary of the retiree for the period of service of the legislator would be based on only those years of service during which that member served as a legislator. 722, 723, and Senate Bill 910 are all Tier 3 proposals, different formulas. Mark is going to actually take you through the costing of those, so I think I'll leave the details of those formulas to Mark to discuss. But as you can see on the sync list, I have, again, outlined what the differences are in those bills. 884, if you recall, is the Senate bill that would allow an employee upon retirement to not only withdraw their account, but to withdraw the employer contribution as well. And as the bill is drafted right now, would terminate any employer liability for that employee. In general, would terminate the employer liability for future COLAs for that employee. Senate Bill 1133 and 1134 are the local government and city-county opt-out bills that we heard in March. 1133 allowing the local government employers to withdraw from PERS, and 1134 allowing a city or county employer to withdraw from PERS. Both are silent at this time with regard to alternative retirement plans that would need to be, if any, offered by those employers. 1135, we did hear a lot about, and that is the bill that would allow an employer to participate in the variable annuity account as an employee can right now. One of the questions there that we have been discussing is the COLA, the cost of living adjustment on the employer, through employer responsibility, and whether or not there ought to be a cap on that COLA. And there's been some concern that just by allowing the employer to participate in the variable account won't necessarily solve the problem, if you will, in the sense that if an additional 2% COLA needs to be added on top of whatever those earnings that the employee happened to enjoy, the employer would still be responsible for that COLA the way the bill is drafted now. There are attached amendments from the PERS board with regard to permitting the Oregon Investment Council to actually reduce the amount of assets that are invested under this proposal if, in fact, the fiscal integrity of the PERS fund would demand that kind of action. In addition to the bills that you have before you, you have some amendments right now drafted as amendments to Senate Bill 723, I believe they're at your places, which would revamp the membership of the PERS board. Instead of having three public members, it would require the appointment of membership of six public members, at least three of whom would have experience in investing or pension management. And then because it doesn't increase the number of members on the PERS board, it makes adjustments in the other specific categories of representation. There are two additional issues that, well, perhaps we can leave those for a later discussion with regard to pooling and crediting of earnings. Maybe we should talk about that when we
get after we
go through the question.
Right.
Okay.
We'll save those. And also at that time, Greg can also walk us through his proposed amendment. Any general questions about the bills that we heard? So, Mark, why don't you come forward? And see if you wish.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Mark Johnson. I'm an actuary, a partner with Milliman & Robertson in Portland. with a contract to provide services for the retirement board. You should have in front of you very shortly a letter dated today. I apologize for the length, but we will go through it as quickly as you allow me to. Please interrupt me at any time if you have questions. And we have previously provided fiscal impact statements on each of the three bills that would create a third tier. And at the request of Senator Bryant and Senator Durfler, we've provided this report summarizing our calculations, providing some comments on how the administration of the third tier would work and any issues associated with that, and then also estimating the potential retirement income that would be generated by each of these three formulas. Now, right now, for a Tier 2 member, which is a member that joined the system in the last few years, service retirement benefits are determined by the greater of two methods, the full formula method, which is a defined benefit program, and the money match method, which is an account balance-driven formula. Members hired prior to 1981 in August are also eligible for a pension plus annuity method. So, well, we've got a program where we're picking the most valuable of at least two, sometimes three formulas. I'd point out that each of these three proposals selects one of those formulas, and at that one proposal is fast. We'll have one formula instead of the best of two or the best of three. Senate Bill 910 is a defined benefit only program. It's very similar to the Tier 2 full formula method with one exception, and that is benefits are capped at 100% of the member's final average salary. Senate Bill 722 is similar in structure to the pension plus annuity method, which is only provided now to members who were hired prior to August of 1981, and that is essentially a combination of a defined benefit program provided by the employer and an account balance benefit provided by the member's contributions. The employer provided pension in Senate Bill 722 is 85 hundredths of a percent multiplied by years of service and final average salary. The 1981 formula is 1% for general service. For police officers, firefighters, and legislators, Senate Bill 722 would provide a 1% formula. The formula for in 1981 was 1.35. So there's some reduction in the benefit levels in the proposed Senate Bill 722 from what was available for members hired prior to 1981. And then the money match in Senate Bill 723 is identical to the money match method that's provided to Tier 2 members. What I'm going to do in the following pages is look at three elements for each bill. The first is what's expected retirement income from these bills, and what we've zeroed in on is looking at the board's goal for normal retirement and a career service. So for general service members, we're looking at the benefits provided at age 60 with 30 years of service. For public safety member, we're looking at retirement at age 55 with 25 years of membership. Now, the second element of our comment will be to look at any issues that might arise from adoption of one of these bills. And the third, then, is to look at the cost. And on page three, what I've outlined in that box is the cost of a new member in Tier 2, because that's what we want to compare it with. The average employer contribution rate in the PERS system right now is 11.40% of payroll. In addition to that, many employers pay the 6%, or the members pay the 6%, so the total cost is 17.40%. That's not a good comparator because that includes Tier 1 benefits, which in some respects are greater than those provided under Tier 2. It also includes an amortization of an unfunded actuarial liability, which is accumulated with respect to current retirees and members in Tier 1. So the correct comparison is between the cost of a new member coming in next year, and that is 7.91% of pay on system average. You can see it varies. An average state agency would be 7.11. Schools are higher, primarily because they have longer service and lower turnover. So the cost for a retirement for school district employees is higher. And then there's a difference between general service and fire and police. between the costs as well because of retirement ages and the benefits provided. So, then to begin on page 4, we'll hit Senate Bill 910 first, which is the full formula method. It's entirely a defined benefit program. The benefit, retirement income, is very predictable. It's only based on years of membership and final average salary. So interest credits, investment return have actually nothing to do with the basic benefit. Therefore, if you look at the box at the top of page 4, if we look at a general service member with 30 years of service retiring at age 60, that member will receive a benefit that's 50% of the final average salary. 50% is derived from 1.67 times 30. At the same time, the police and fire member retiring with 25 years of service at age 55 will also receive 50% of the final average salary. Again, 2% times 25 years is 50%. The only exception to that replacement ratio would be an employee's voluntary participation in the variable annuity program. An employee, by investing some of the member contributions in the Oregon Equity Fund, can take a risk and enhance benefits. At the same time, the risk goes the other way, and benefits could be reduced. So there's no employer implication to participation in the variable annuity. However, it could affect retirement income. Employers will bear all of the investment risk for this basic benefit. The contributions of the employer will increase if investment performance is poor. The contributions will decrease if investment performance is greater than expected. The members bear no risk with respect to the level of benefits. Other than that, it's voluntarily through the variable annuity program. That's the nature of a defined benefit retirement plan. The current problems that are associated with additional employer liabilities arising from good investment returns would, for the most part, be eliminated with this particular benefit structure. Right now, what has happened is that through the money match program, because account balances are so high, employers have additional obligations because the employers are funding cost of living benefits. So that since the benefits are so much higher, there's an additional employer obligation for cost of living. That would not happen here because the benefits that the employer is obligated to fund do not vary by investment return. I also would point out, just as an aside, that the 100% cap is not going to come into play because in order to reach that, a general service member would need 60 years of service in the system, and a police or fire member would need 50 years of service in the system, highly unlikely. The actuarial cost on page 5, and I don't know that we want to go today through all of these numbers, but they're here for you to look at. By type of benefit, that is service retirement, vested benefit, which is the benefit that a person receives if they're vested, but they leave and they come back later to draw a benefit. Withdrawal means somebody leaving and taking their money with them, and death and disability. Subtracting the member contributions of the normal cost, and then allocated by state, schools, and then the two types of members of the local agency. System-wide, the employer contribution in Tier 3 for Senate Bill 910 is 4.94% of pay. So the employees would be paying 6%, the employer would be paying 4.94%. That's almost 3% less than Tier 2 current estimates. Significantly lower cost. And the basic reason is we're no longer taking the best of two or the best of three. It's simply the defined benefit program where we don't have the risk to the employer of increased obligations when there's a good investment return and the ratcheting up of benefits.
And the important thing here, that percentage does not include the 6% kick-up, where in most collective bargaining contracts I'm aware of, the employer picks up the 6%.
Right. And the reason we presented it this way is to come down to the bottom line, which is the difference or the cost savings. The other thing that's not in the rate, Senator Bryant, is the pooled cost of retiree medical, which currently is 70 basis points. But since that would still be here in this proposal, that would have been added back on page 3, also added here on page 5. It'd come out the bottom line, the savings would be the same of almost 3% of pay.
Would you just remind the committee what that 0.7 basis points for those medical benefits are?
Senator Bryant, the statute allows retirees to participate in a PERS-sponsored health insurance program after eligibility for Medicare. If a PERS member does participate in that program, there is a $60 per month subsidy against the premium for that program that is paid for by the fund. That the ongoing cost, if you were to fund it now for somebody you just hired, is 20 basis points. The reason the cost is 70 basis points is there's about a half a billion dollar unfunded liability associated with this program because it was provided to current retirees at the time it was adopted with no funds available and not accumulating over their working lifetime to help save for that. So we have been in the hole, and we're now out of the hole with a very small asset base, but we have a huge unfunded liability, which will be funded over 30 years.
We have no contractual obligation to fund that $60 million, a month subsidy?
Oh, yes. Well, I don't know if there's a contractual obligation, but from an actuarial standpoint, it makes good sense for Senator Brown to do that. And there is a provision in every employer's contribution rate to pay for that. My point is that of the 70 basis points, 20 basis points is for the ongoing cost of people who are working now. 50 basis points is catch-up because the benefit was provided to retirees long after some of them long after they stopped working. So there wasn't any advanced funding for the program.
Right. But is there a contractual obligation to fund that?
Not for new tiers.
Okay.
But for existing tiers or retirees, yes.
And can that be means tested?
I don't know. We'll have to have Mr. Mayor that.
Okay. Okay.
And if you change the law, then would that, you could change the law.
Okay. Future retirees. Okay.
Right. And then that would save you about 20 basis points. You can't, by changing the law, you can't save yourself the half a billion dollar unfunded liability. That's there.
Right. But future you could.
Correct. If you're ready to go on page 6, we talk about Senate Bill 722, which is...
Question about 910. Where did that plan come from?
All the plans came from Senator Durfer and myself.
But, like, private sector? I mean, did you copy a plan in the private sector? Did you copy a plan in a nonprofit? I mean, where was the model that was used to do this?
I can't answer that.
For which, Senator?
For Senate Bill 910.
That is the current full formula. It's one. Right now we have three different methodologies that are calculated at the time somebody retires. And retiree gets the one that has the greatest value. Senate Bill 910 takes one of those calculation methods, which is the defined benefit program. So it's essentially identical to one of the pieces right now that's being used, and that's the model that was used. It's been in effect since 1981 in the system. The full formula.
And the difference here is that it's just one, but we're not going to allow it to be a choice. We'll mandate it for all employees after a certain time. Is that what we're doing here with this piece of legislation?
You could. If you wanted to, you could make it a mandatory that this would be the new one for current employees. You could also.
As the bill is drafted, this would be mandatory for employees hired after a certain date.
That's what I mean. The bill is drafted, mandated for all employees hired.
The bill is drafted, it is mandated.
Thank you.
Likewise, Senate Bill 722 was drafted to be mandating the second of the three formulas, which is the pension plus annuity. In estimating retirement income, it's a little more difficult to do it under this particular approach because it's not entirely a defined benefit program. Part of it is, but the other part is an annuity driven by the value of a member's account balance at the time of retirement. The replacement ratio, therefore, depends on how large the account balance is. And rather than just assuming our 8% long-term assumption, what I did was prefer to show you a range of what the benefit level might be for a 30-year employee rather than just the midpoint, which would be about 48% of final average salary. Based upon percentile, the 25th and the 75th percentile, we would expect over a 30-year period the range of investment return to be between 6.42% and 9.58%. If we had plugged in 6.42% for 30 years, the replacement ratio for the member would be 42% of final average salary. If the account balance earns 9.58% for 30 years, the replacement ratio is higher because the account balance is higher, it would be 54%. I think the thing to note here is that the projected retirement income is not as sufficient, if you will, as Senate Bill 910's income, and in particular, the public safety replacement ratio at the normal retirement age of 55 with 25 years of service lags quite a bit. I think of interest to the bottom of page 6, the investment risk is now shared between the members and the employers. To the extent that there are good returns, the employer's contribution on the defined benefit piece will go down, and the member's benefit on the account balance piece of the equation will go up. So there's a sharing of the risk and how the benefits are derived from investment return. The impact on future employer liabilities associated with good investment return is still there, because to the extent that the account balance is driven up by good investment return, the cost of living payments on that piece of the benefit is still an obligation of the employer. So we're not ridding ourselves, if you will, of the obligation to pay for cost of living, which has been one of the issues on the money match method. The disability retirement calculation, I'd point out, is based on the full formula. I don't know if that was a drafting error or just overlooked, but the disability portion of this particular tier is kind of mixed and matched. So I would suggest if this is the tier that this is the benefit structure that you're looking at, my suggestion would be to change the disability benefit to be a function of pension plus annuity, not full formula. And then the last bullet, there was some language that appeared to be misplaced that we've already talked to the Legislative Council about, and it's being taken care of. At the bottom of page 7, then we have the replacement ratios for what I've called the 1981 pension plus annuity. The discussions we've had with Legislative Council on the derivation of the 8,500ths for general service on the employer-provided pension and the 1% on the employer-provided pension for public safety is that was not done with a lot of sophistication, trying to match values, if you will, from the full formula what the retirement goals might be. Therefore, we were asked to look at what the replacement ratios would be if we did meet the retirement board's goals of basically 50% at age 60 with 30 years. And what we did was we went back to the old 1981 formula, the 1% for general service folks and the 1.35 for public safety members. And you see those results in the box at the bottom of page 7, where we would expect a range of retirement replacement income between 46 and 58%. For general service member, between 47 and 53% for a public safety member. Again, much more likely to meet the retirement board's goals than the bill as drafted. At the top of page 8, we go through the cost first of Senate Bill 722 as drafted. The savings are substantial. The cost, the employer contribution on system average for Senate Bill 722 and new members joining the system is 4.87% of pay, a savings of over 3% from the current estimated cost of Tier 2. We made two changes or two revisions and reran the cost. At the bottom of page 8, you'll see two bullets. The first bullet is we changed the multipliers back to what the 1981 pension plus annuity formula is. And then we put the disability benefit to be more consistent with what the service retirement benefit is based on pension plus annuity. And there you see the savings at the top of page 9 of 1.47% instead of 3%. So that change, I've cut the savings in half. The employer contribution now would be expected to be 6.44% of pay rather than 7.91% for a current Tier 2 new entrant. Page 10, we talk about the last of the three bills, which is Senate Bill 723. And this bill takes the money match calculation method and makes that the sole determinant of benefits under Tier 3. Replacement ratios in the box at the top of page 10, 52% for general service, but notice the wide range. I use the same, the 25th and 75th percentile, so there's a 50% chance that over 30 years the member's benefit's going to fall within that range. Look at how much wider the range is, and that's because the entire benefit is driven by the account balance. So that even though 52% is the midpoint, it could be as low as 40% or as high as 66%. The second thing to notice on the box is that the public safety replacement ratio is nowhere near the board's goal. And the reason for that is that there's no disparity here between the benefit provided to public safety members versus general service members. It's the same benefit. It's the money match benefit. And it's not going to provide the same level of benefits after 25 years as it would after 30 years. So, again, that's just to point out there is no disparity. Now, right now, of course, there is no disparity in that money match formula for public safety members, but our evidence is that there are many more retirement benefits calculated under the full formula or pension plus annuity method for current public safety retirees than the money match, because the money match, is much more prevalent with general service members. On this particular third tier, again, the inconsistency with the public safety members. Secondly, members bear the entire investment risk for their benefit. The benefit is derived strictly from the value of the account balance multiplied by 2. Hence the wide range, if you will. And not only a wide range, but it could be a dramatic drop or increase in any one-year period. You could have an October of 87 where somebody was expecting to retire in November or December of 87, and all of a sudden their entire lifetime benefit could be down substantially. Based upon, I guess it wouldn't be month by month, but retiring the next year, certainly, because the PERS credits interest once a year. So much more volatility. The actuarial costs, interestingly, it does not save as much as the others. Now, part of it has to do with longer service retirees under this scenario are going to have a higher cost because their benefits are going to be higher, and people who retire early, who are eligible to retire, let's say, at age 55 but have low service, will actually have a better benefit under money match, which is current today as well, because of the nature of defined benefit. We've got early retirement reductions if you're not 30 years of service, for example. That doesn't happen with the money match. So the savings, again, on Senate Bill 723 is not near the savings on 722 or 910. On page 12, we've summarized this in one box. And I guess just a comment or two about, look, if you look at them all at the same time, the Senate Bill 910 and 722 as drafted are about the same cost. I'm looking at the far right-hand column, the employer contribution for 910 is 4.94%, 4.87 for 722. But remember, I don't think 722 does justice to the replacement ratio, the benefit needed to meet the board's goal. So if that were revised, as we looked at in this letter, the employer cost would be 6.44%. And then 723, 7.19. Pension plus annuity is somewhat more valuable than the full formula, again, for longer service people and for people who retire at the earliest stages. And money match is even more so. Now, the other thing to consider is that these savings do not happen immediately. Because we're dealing with a new tier, that means that this benefit structure is only being applied to members hired after a certain date. So What I did was I converted these cost savings, which are basically ultimately going to occur after we've got a whole generation of employees on third tier. And, but that can happen quickly for a small employer. A small employer with one or two PERS members could have all tier three membership next year. A large employer, it may take 30 years or more before they've got everyone on tier three. So what we've done is we've taken turnover that we've seen as experienced by the average PERS employer and projected what percentage of the membership would be on tier three. If you look at the box at the top of page 13, obviously when you start, there's nobody in tier three. There's no savings at all. But 5 years later, we expect about 35% of the members to be in the third tier. And that's consistent. I can tell you now, in the last valuation where we've had tier two for about a year and a half before we did the December 97 valuation, 11% of the active population was in tier two. So that's consistent with this as well. So I think these are pretty legitimate expectations. Again, taking a long time before the ultimate savings. So what we've done here in the four right-hand columns is predict what the percentage of payroll savings would be by this influx of new Tier 3 members that are having a lower cost than the current Tier 2. And again, ultimately, the cost savings are the same as you've seen on the previous pages. The last point that I wanted to make was that because PERS performs biennial valuations every 2 years, if you adopted this now, the next valuation that would include members of new tiers would be performed as of December 31st, 2001. The next valuation is expected to be performed December 31st, 1999, but you won't have any Tier 3 members in place because it takes 6 months of eligibility and so forth until into the year 2000. So the first time we'll see this in evaluation is sometime in the spring or summer of the year 2002. If the board follows its current practice, the previous history of allowing employers a certain lag time for budgeting purposes, we would expect to see employer rates first affected by a third-tier proposal in July of the year 2003. So that, again, the perspective is, I showed you some savings. They're going to come in slowly, and they're not going to start for a few years. Those are the two comments I had on how this is implemented. Senator Bryan, I believe I answered your questions from this week. If there are any more questions or any additional information, I'd be happy to try to address them.
Well, my compliments. You did this in a very few days in a way that's it's not a subject that's easy to understand, but you did it, I think, as easy as possible. We'll be going to Sunday and Nelson.
Excuse me, what was the retirement goal? I wasn't here, I guess, when you said that.
The retirement board has a goal, and again, it's the legislature that adopts the benefits, but their goal is to try to see that members have 75% of their final average salary replaced by retirement income from two sources, state retirement system and Social Security. Social Security varies by your salary level, so the board has taken 50% for a career employee to represent their expectation of retirement income from PERS. And career employee they've defined as 30 years for general service and 25 years for police and fire. Normal retirement age in the statute is age 60 for general service and 55 for police and fire. That's how we got to age 60 and 30 years and 55 and 25 years. So for the purposes of this report, trying to zero in on 50% of final average salary.
Okay, thank you. Just one more. On page 13, where you got the 910, 722, and those, which, did you go through defined benefit and defined contribution and money match, and which ones are those again?
Absolutely. Senate Bill 910, first one on the left, is the full formula only. That's a strictly defined benefit program. Senate Bill 722 is a reinstitution of the old Pension Plus Annuity program that was eliminated in 1981. That is a combination defined benefit and account balance plan. The employer pays for the defined benefit program, and the member is funding the account balance piece of the program. My revision to that is that, at the suggestion of Senator Bryant, was to look at the replacement ratios that were generated from 722 and to make adjustments as necessary to bring it into compliance or reasonable compliance with the board's goals. So my revised Senate Bill 722 has a slightly higher cost and cuts the savings here about in half. Then again, that is still a pension plus annuity, the combination plan. And then Senate Bill 723 is all account now. It's basically the money match program we have now, but eliminating the full formula. So that's the whole spectrum.
Senator Brown.
I have a couple questions. One, and I'm sorry, I've missed most of your testimony, but as I look at this chart, Senate Bills 910, 722, and 723 do not at all in any way resolve the unfunded liability problems, correct?
Neither does 723. Yeah, none of these resolve unfunded liability problems. Problem in the sense that employers are currently funding over 30 years some liabilities that have been generated from the past. Not all employers. Some have surpluses that are reducing their rates, but many of the larger employers particularly have unfunded liabilities. Starting a new tier does not address that problem.
Just a couple of follow-ups. How much relief savings did we get by instituting Tier 2? And then can you compare for us the difference between Tier 1 and the three new options?
Yes.
Okay.
The difference between Tier 1 and Tier 2 is slightly less than 1% of pay.
Okay.
It's about 95 basis points. When it was adopted, it was predicted to be a much larger savings. But when it was adopted, you were operating under the assumption that a ballot measure, I believe it was number 8, was in effect, which would have taken away the unused sick leave portion of adjusting your retirement benefits. When the Supreme Court overruled that and unused sick leave came back, then the savings for Tier 2 wasn't nearly as large as the savings that you had thought it was when you adopted the second tier. Tier 1 is similar to Tier 2 in that all three of these calculation methods are available in Tier 1. The major differences in the Tier 2 are this. Number one, on an employee account balance, there is no minimum guaranteed interest rate. In Tier 1, there's a, other than monies that you put at risk in the variable, the member is guaranteed to earn at least what the actuary assumes in the long-term funding of the system, which currently is 8% interest. So there's an 8% floor, if you will, on interest in Tier 1. There is no such floor in Tier 2. That makes a big difference in the cost because we can say that the average interest credit in the future in Tier 2 is 8%. We can't say that the average interest credit in Tier 1 is 8% because the minimum is going to be 8. So the average interest credits on a member's account balance in Tier 1 are going to be significantly higher than Tier 2. The second difference is that the normal retirement age was raised from 58 to 60 for general service people. The third difference, going by memory here, is that the definition of salary changed in that unused vacation pay can no longer be added into the calculation of final average salary at retirement. And I believe there are one or two other minor changes. But the big change in Tier 2 driving the cost was the elimination of the minimum interest rate on the member's account balance.
Thank you.
Since you said the goal was to put the person 75% of their base salary, combining the benefit they get from the retirement plan and Social Security, I can assume whether it's a low of 30% return up to, or up to 66%, that Social Security will get them to 75%.
No. It's not like Social Security is going to automatically fill it in. Social Security is calculated independently of PERS, and PERS is calculated independently of Social Security. Social Security is heavily weighted toward lower paid individuals. In other words, if you look at replacement ratios as we are here, the replacement ratio, and I haven't looked at this in a while, but let me take a guess. The replacement ratio for somebody with a $20,000 salary per year might be 40 or 50%. Okay, so if you, that might bring somebody from, 50% in PERS and 50% in Social Security if they were making a relatively low salary. On the other hand, if somebody's making a $30,000 salary, the replacement ratio might be 35 or 40%. Or a $50,000 salary, replacement ratio for Social Security might be 20% or 25%. So you can't really zero in on designing a PERS benefit such that in combination with Social Security, it's going to equal 75%. In fact, it's against federal law to do that. You cannot, because what you would be doing then would be providing a PERS benefit that would be heavily weighted to higher paid people in order for it to equal 75% for everybody, and that's against the federal law.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do is just zero in on something that on average, and for most, I think for the majority of PERS retirees, they're going to be in a range where the Social Security is somewhat in the neighborhood of 25%.
The other factor on the 75% were benefits that were provided. That included also in the...
Well, the goal is to provide 75% from PERS and Social Security.
And that's a PERS goal.
Right.
So PERS is rolling the dice on Social Security. In view of everything you just said, they're rolling the dice. It's illegal for them to screw around. In terms of who around there, it's independent. They're rolling the dice.
Right. If Social Security were to go defunct,
they're still rolling the dice. You've got case officers here after 25 years, 55 years, so they're 55. They fought fires and protected us for 25 years under 723. They could have as low as 30% return on their retirement plan. So the Social Security, he's got to go 40-45%, or they're nowhere near 75%.
So not only that, Social Security won't kick in at age 55, 62, if you're lucky you can get it. So, yeah, no, that's my point here is that 7.3 doesn't work for police and fire. There's a high likelihood it's not going to work.
Well, it's not real... And it's not a real good deal under 722, is it?
Which is why, on page 6, no, it's not a good deal as it's drafted. But if you go to the bottom of page 7, with our, tinkering around as Senator Bryant asked us to do, then it becomes more palatable. Bottom of page 7.
I had to change the ratio in order to bring it up within the range.
So, the bottom line is, as long as it's 50%, it's actuarially a pretty good deal in terms of long-term savings, in terms of protection of the employer's risk and liability and all that kind of thing.
That would be my opinion. And the reason that a member does not need 100% of their final salary to maintain the same standard of living, I mean, the 75% is designed for the retiree to be able to maintain their same standard of living. Well, you don't have any Social Security taxes anymore. You don't have a PERS pickup anymore. A lot of your expenses associated with working are gone. You're in a lower tax bracket a lot of times. So, there are a lot of... comprehensive studies that would show you that you don't need 100% of your last year's salary to maintain the same standard of living, and 75% is right about the middle of all those studies.
But 50% would not be a good deal either.
That is correct. So we're counting on Social Security in partnership with PERS.
I want to ask one last thing since I got a health insurance issue.
Go ahead.
I got a health insurance issue. Is this health insurance is all in here? They don't have to sweat that either?
My understanding is that all three of these proposals retain the
the ability for a member to get the $60 subsidy at Medicare eligibility if they're enrolled in the PERS-sponsored program. And I believe, Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, most retirees are also eligible for some PERS-sponsored health insurance at their cost if they're not eligible for Medicare.
They have to go to Kaiser Permanente versus being able to choose their own doctors and things like that. I mean, you know, health. I'd like a little bit more pointedly to respond, if you can, as to what kind of coverage we're talking about, as opposed to just saying they get $66.
Yeah.
They get health insurance. You know, there's different types in terms of.
I hear you, and you need another expert to give you that information. I'm not aware of that.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Delaney, Manager of Government Relations at PERS. I'm not an expert on the health insurance. I can tell you, Senator, that with regard to these bills, they do not take away the current health benefits being offered to PERS retirees. So our understanding is, as drafted, 722, 723, 910 would leave in place the current benefits being offered to both to Tier 2 retirees. Now, as for the details of what current Tier 2 retirees are being offered, I'm afraid I don't have those at my fingertips.
Thank you very much.
And one comment on that. If you return, you know, you start off retiring, and you run off figures in the Social Security and everything else, so that's not the standard of living that I want. Because with class people, as you
look all your questions, you're about to find another job. If it doesn't matter, if you
as a public employee, you can work longer, and your wages are designated to us, and you have another year of multiply on the
I think it's just sort of a follow-up on both of your comments, and I don't remember the numbers, but my recollection is we have a fairly large number of folks in the public system that make less than $30,000 a year. Is that correct? I'm getting some head nods. Is it 50%?
Bob, why don't you come up? This is Bob Mayer, Attorney General.
Yes. The numbers are actually seen by the actuary, but I've seen the numbers. I think that's more typical of the population of PERS members in the $30,000 range. In terms of percentages, very few are in the $40,000, $50,000,
$60,000 range. So if we're assuming their PERS benefit is going to be at about 50% of their salary, that means about in the neighborhood of $15,000 a year. That's without the Social Security. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Good questions. Now, the COLA, if you could explain briefly how that works and how that's determined.
The current statute provides that a member on August 1st would receive a 2% increase in their monthly benefit if the CPI in the previous calendar year went up at least 2%. So there is a cap on the COLA at 2% per year. There's also what's called a CPI bank, and that came into play this year because the CPI from 1997 to 1998 went up by 1.9%. But most retirees will get a 2% increase in August, even though the CPI only went up 1.9, and that's because in prior years the CPI went up higher than 2%, and that difference is banked, so that almost every retiree, except those that just retired within the last year, will receive 2%. Those who retired in the last year will receive 1.89%. That benefit is funded by employers. In other words, when an account balance is converted to a monthly benefit, that conversion is done at an interest rate that assumes a level payment over life expectancy, and then the employer is funding for cost of living. What we have done is factored in the liabilities for all future cost of living like that into employer contribution rates, so that by the time a member retires, there's enough money in the fund not only to pay for their basic benefit, but to pay for the 2% automatic cost of living increase. The second type of protection of purchasing power, if you will, that has been enacted by the legislature. It's called an ad hoc increase. The last one was adopted in 1989. And there has been a special one-time, if you will, increase in retirement benefits to bring those benefits more in line with purchasing power, because for many years the CPI was going up much greater than 2%, and the 2% has only been around, I believe, since the late 70s. So, and those are funded in arrears. You know, we don't fund for an ad hoc increase in advance. We wait for you to adopt one, and then we'll pay for it over the next 30 years. So all past ad hoc increases have been fully paid for.
Today we're almost done for the day, and I was trying to talk to Ann. I listened to my questions that were being answered, and I apologize. Did you receive a copy of a memo that to send over for myself from Fred about the questions we asked? If not, we'll make copies for you. But it was 10 or 11, 12 questions.
I see.
Right. I also provided you copies of some legal opinions and some questions, and Bob is prepared to answer those. And then we need to talk also about the pooling, the earnings credits, the legal questions we'll get into, what reserves there are and why. And so we're trying to pick a time to do this next week. Gentlemen, are you generally available next week? What I'm thinking of is another hour of general information to ask questions. And then, yes. Beginning with.
Oh. Who can you be gone? Or, I could see why you could be gone.
Would your parents like to come to Salem? Is there anyone over at the department that could cover for you?
No.
The last two, Elizabeth. Can you deputize her for a day? All right. We'll get this scheduled. I'll look at my schedule and try and give everyone notice. And continue to move in this direction. We are adjourned, and I remind them what they need to head to the house.